Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Here we go. Man, oh man. It seems like we just did this yesterday. Well, I guess we did, some of us. Wrapped up chapter 17. We'll be in chapter 18 today of the book of Revelation. Rome is fallen, or Babylon is fallen, or Babylon is destroyed, depending on how you look at it. As you remember from last time, Babylon is being used by John to refer to Rome, because the cities have a lot in common based on their idolatrous and luxurious and just kind of crazy oppressive ways in which they lived and existed and oppressed those the have-nots. It's probably one way to say that. The story or the conversation or the passages here of chapter 18 is actually broke down into a couple sections, as we'll see. We'll see verses 1 through 3, where an angel comes down from heaven and illuminates the earth, announcing with the authority of God that Rome has fallen. It seems to be another angel that we get introduced here as well. Section of verses 4 through 8, we hear another from heaven calling to the people of God to come out of the city, for it is about to receive a double portion of suffering, for it is inflicted on others. So we see many things as we roll through this related to what's going to be happening to Rome and what's going to be happening to the people who are and remained faithful. But what we ultimately see here in this chapter is that the once proud and powerful city of Rome, even you could refer to it as the Roman Empire, has been brought to ruin. But specifically here, he's talking about Rome, the city, because of everything it's done. And if you want more information on that, you can go back to, of course, chapter 17. We talked a lot about that. We'll talk a little bit more about Rome's role as well, but you'll really need to look at chapter 17 before you can jump into chapter 18 here. What I'll do as we go through this is we will look at, let me read verses 1 through 8 here. And we'll go there and then we'll continue on. But the first group of verses will be chapter 18, verses 1 through 8. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. This is the authority of God on the angel, with that authority able to shine upon the earth. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the great. She has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality." Pretty much, I mean, Rome and Babylon, as I said here, are hand in hand and related to how they're both this level of immorality and sensuality. I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins, receive of her plagues, for her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back even as she is paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds, in the cup which she has mixed, mix twice as much for her. To the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning, for she says in her heart, 'I sit as a queen, and I am not a widow, and will never see mourning.'" You may see that in all caps there as you read through this. "For this reason, in one day her plagues will come, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong." So we see here seems to be another angel, verse 1, or one that we have not seen before. We know that the angel is of authority, as it has come from God and is reflecting the glory and radiance of God, illuminating the earth that has become dark, because the earth is dark with evil. Light being good, dark being evil. Some take this to be what is seen in Ezekiel chapter 43, verses 1 through 5, where the glory of God returns to the temple through the east gate, lighting up the temple. So that could be one reference that John is using here. We know that John references Ezekiel throughout this book, as well as Isaiah and Jeremiah and some of the other prophets. We know from the book of Exodus that those who come from the presence of God are marked by a lingering radiance. Remember Moses coming down from Mount Sinai. I think that's in Exodus 34. You'll see Jesus, his illuminated face is at some points, and there's some other cases as well. When the angel is to proclaim what seem impossible to those who are hearing these words from John, so nobody would expect the complete destruction of Rome. It just was too powerful. Someone would say too big to fail, and we know how that works. So that we know that that is never a true case. It seems that what John is trying to tell them is that God is now responding to the cries of the martyrs from the fifth seal. So, which is what, chapter 6-ish, I believe. So that's where we're coming from here. And John is, so again, we have the destruction of Rome, whilst at the same time we have the hope of the martyrs and the hope of the faithful as we go through this. So the destruction of those who are not faithful, and the redemption of those who are, and that's continuation, a kind of a common thread that runs through this. As we go into verse 2, what we see here is a reflection from Isaiah chapter 21, verse 9, when the news that Cyrus had captured Babylon reached the people of Israel. In the same way, the angel cries out in a loud voice that Babylon the Great has fallen. We know historically that Babylon has always been in the way, or has been a symbol of the opposition of an opposition to God and the advancement of the kingdom of God. So the evil of Babylon, the evil of Rome, has been in the way or an obstacle to the advancement of the kingdom of God. As it has fallen in the past, Babylon has fallen in the past, it will fall again. It will again, God will remove Babylon, much like it has previously. God has previously. The people reading along would know historically what God did to Babylon in the past by giving Rome the same name here as in Revelation. It will tell the people that God will now take out Rome as he took out Babylon. So again, there's that piece of hope for those who are listening carefully and not getting too caught up in these awesome, probably looking angels flying around or visiting them in the area. The usage of let's get a little grammatical here, of an aorist tense is telling us that it will certainly happen. There's a certainty of future fulfillment. So when you see aorist-like words, that always looks to the future and that there will be a fulfillment. It's a certainty that what is being said will happen. The once great Babylon will fall and will become the place of evil spirits, become a place of 40 evil spirits and unclean creatures. This is a reference that Isaiah taught back in Isaiah 13, 20 through 21, that the great Babylon would fall and only be inhabited again by wild creatures or by demonic type creatures. There is some debate related to this about the use of the word haunt. In this verse, it is used here three separate times. Some have taken it to mean the word home, which it could, because Greek has that tendency to use sometimes words that we don't typically would associate with it, or maybe multiple meanings. As it is in this place where unclean spirits and animals have just been a brief time or will be detained there, but that is where they will dwell. So there's some pieces and parts to that that we can look into. Some of them say dwelling place, and others say, what is this what I'm talking about? A lair. So lair, haunt, home, dwelling place. Again, it seems like that is where evil will remain. It's not just a kind of a stop based on a stop on the journey of life. It's not what they're referring to here. Verse 3. In this verse, we learn the reason for the fall of Rome. Notice that it's not all about just Rome at this point. There's a progression of intoxicated nations, kings of the earth, the merchants from all over the world partaking. This also includes some seafarers / mariners that we'll be talking about here in a little bit. They have drunk the wines of adultery from Rome, and it is not a good wine. We know that the use of adultery in the Old Testament is, of course, to show apostasy against God. If you go back to Hosea chapter 4, verse 10, it is to show the unclean relationships between Rome and the rest of the world, which is just fascinating how John is tying all of this together. Through these adulterous relationships that we have here, the merchants of the world have become very wealthy. And that's, of course, very, very good for them. Not good for anyone else who hasn't become wealthy, because it's been on the backs of those who have not become wealthy. This self-indulgent and excessive luxury with arrogance and wanton exercise of strength has, for the most part, infected the entire earth. Not a good thing, not something that has been good for anyone, but it's not everyone is thriving in a situation like this, especially this time, the Christian church. As we go into verse 4, we hear from another voice here, most likely another angel that is speaking with God's authority. We see the reference of my people would designate God as the speaker, but the following verse has God in the third person. So, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive her of her plagues, for her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. It's very interesting how that works. So we could say that it is most likely an angel speaking. The warning that we have here to those are my people are similar to what Isaiah and Jeremiah both cried out to the people. For example, in Isaiah 52:11. Where it says, depart, depart, go out from there, touch no unclean things. So there's a similar sort of prophetic warning that John is providing that Isaiah had provided as well. Those prophets like to provide warnings such as this. Unfortunately, many times people do not heed such warnings. We know that calls like this have reflected the call of separation of God's elect through human history. Here it is, those who are faithful also could be called the elect, even though it's not a predetermined thing. This is not a deterministic conversation, but as those who are faithful and remain faithful. We could then say throughout history it has been those who continue to be faithful. We're looking at a literal flight from a doomed city of Rome, and I don't like to say literal too much when I talk about Revelation, but it seems here that's what John is trying to get to. Similar to when the Jews fled Pella, when Jerusalem fell back in 20 years prior, 70 AD. You always have to say the AD first, but BC is second, so it would be AD 70. I guess you don't have to, but that seems to be the proper way. I could start doing BC and BCE before Common Era, and Common Era, CE, BCE. But we're not going to do that because it offends some. Anyways, this literal flight we're looking at here, but we also can project this onto a larger frame of history and see that it is also the last generation of the believers to spiritually withdraw from the adulterous ways of the world. So that's what's going to happen to those at the consummation of human history. They will try to escape or get away from whatever city is deemed to be Babylon at that time. It may be more than the city. But as we know, the church has always faced the temptation of compromise to worldliness in order to make a life a bit easier or less hostile. There's actually a guy this morning talking about air conditioning, and that's something that makes life a whole lot easier, and it's not sure about the hostility, but it does make life easier. And he suggested that if it's not at least 90 degrees, there's no reason to have air conditioning. And I thought, well, you've never lived in Houston with humidity at also 90%. And anyways, sidebar, but it does. Not saying that that's what this is or that air conditioning is an evil, but some people think it is. Anyways, separation is what we are called sometimes in a physical, but also in an ideological way. So this separation of the faithful from those who are not faithful. Two reasons are given for the fleeing too, as well, and they are tied to sin and judgment, so as not to share in the sin of Rome, as well as not to receive the plagues that Rome will face. So that's why they should leave, because they should not have to share in something that they have not done, the sin, and they should not have to then deal with the punishment. The use of saint is to set a believer apart from the world for God for a holy purpose. It's not a specific type of person. It's not a higher level or someone of higher value. All believers are saints according to how it is used in the New Testament when you see Paul refer to saints, as well as in this case. Saints are all people who are faithful in God in this context. Verse 5, sin, you have sin upon sin stacking up to heaven. Some have looked at this as the gluing together of the leaves of a scroll where the sin of Rome is recorded. When it is unrolled, it would reach to heaven. It is that much sin. It's a little bit, just not a whole lot on that. So we're going to run right into verse 6 where there's some payment that's happening here, or some payback. The voice from heaven continues to speak. We see another triplet in regards to the repayment that should be given to Rome for the horrors it has brought to the church. There's multiple triplets that John likes to use. I'll point out a few in this chapter. The triplet here being to give back to Rome as she has given, to pay her back double for what she has done, and to mix a double portion for her own cup. That's just a literary device, a literary device that John is using to help make a point about the significance of what is happening. Babylon has shed the blood of prophets and saints and will now receive the kind of reward for her cruelty. I find it interesting that cities are referred to as she's, and so we have these really evil female representations here, but we know that's not true. It's just women are not evil. That's not the point here, but it's kind of how this is playing out, at least as a city being a she, which, and if a city is not evil, then it's, and it's good, because cities can be good. I mean, I don't know if they can be either way. Are they immoral? Amoral. Well, just getting way off target today. So this idea of being given back for the cruelty that in return for what she has given, the martyrs that we learned about in chapter 6 no longer have to wait for God to avenge the death of all of whose faith has been conquered by the sword. What is being called for in this context is punishment reward beyond the idea of lex talionis, which is, of course, the eye for an eye. That's a very much a oft and used Latin term for that. This is to go well beyond that, based on the enlightenment of Rome and what Rome has done. And the way she made the nations drink the maddening wine of her adultery, she must now drink the wrath of God. We're moving right along here. We're going into verse 7. We have a second command for judgment in the first part of this verse, and we get a new wrinkle. Rome is to receive misery in the exact proportion in which it claimed its own self-glorification and luxurious lifestyle that it had chosen. The harlot Babylon is to be smitten by the Lord. This is not like a smitten kitten, but instead to be smited or struck by God. So let's make sure we stay there. There's no smitten God here. It's a God who will smite these people or that city. This lack of humility that we see here of Rome, we know from Proverbs or Luke 14:11 that the one who is prideful will be humbled, or everyone who exalts himself will be humbled. We now get a bit more reasons for the judgment. Rome sees herself as the mistress of the world without any personal loss or sorrow. We can reflect on a similar monologue from Isaiah chapter 47, verses 7 through 8. A lot of references to Isaiah, Jeremiah, as we continue to go through this. The comment regarding not being a widow is not about her not having lovers, but instead, or a husband even, but instead shows that Rome has not experienced any debilitating effects of war or loss of life, as in has not been widowed because of an excessive loss of either armies or individual soldiers or loss in large battles. So that's where that is coming from. Rome has remained victorious up to this point. There's been no mourning in her streets. And if we can take this a bit further, this is not about arrogance, but that the belief that Rome has inexhaustible resources. No sense of lack, or probably better said, again, like I said earlier, too big to fail. It is the belief that nothing could ever happen to Rome to make Rome go away. Well, that's not true. Look at Greece. Rome. There's other cases of that as well. Probably not as severe as those two, but pretty severe. Verse 8, the last part of this section. The arrogance and self-confidence will mean the plagues will come upon her suddenly and will be utterly devastated by God's judgment. Rome, who has drunk on the blood of prophets and saints, as we know from chapter 17 and also from chapter 18:24, we haven't seen that yet, will suddenly meet a like disaster. They will face the three plagues of death, of death, mourning, and famine. Some have pointed to this as a coming attack of the Parthians. As we know, the Parthians were a large coming up powerful nation to the east of Rome that was threatening Rome and eventually would sack Rome. And the idea would be that Nero, or a spirit of Nero, would be their leader. And what they would do is, so you have the famine, the death, and the mourning. The cut off the food supply is the famine part. The lead to pestilence is the death, and prepare for destruction by fire is the mourning. So those three things that are listed here is about what they would see. We know that judgment is by fire is a typical use throughout biblical text for judgment. For example, in Jeremiah, we see references in chapter 51. That Babylon will be a burned out mountain whose dwellings, marshes, and high gates will be set on fire. It's got to be pretty intense fire to burn all of that. In the ancient times, anytime someone saw smoke coming out of a city, they would know that the burning city has collapsed. Once it is burning, there really is nothing people can do to stop the fire. For Rome, it will be God who will bring judgment to Rome with fire. Through all this fire and destruction of Rome, the people of the church who were oppressed by the government would know that the judgment of God on Rome would bring hope. God has not forsaken them. So that is the hope that they have, even though it sounds pretty brutal. Everyone has an opportunity to be faithful and instead of hardening your heart towards God. And so you have to always keep that in mind as we read through this. And as you read through other parts of Revelation, there are times and time and time and time and time again where God allows and provides opportunity for everyone to be faithful. So it's not like all of a sudden these people are getting smited. It is, they have had ample opportunity. We have ample opportunity to turn to God and be faithful in our belief. So just as we wrap this up, with the imminent demise of Rome on the horizon, as unbelievable as it would be from the looks of Rome's current position, was an indication that the sovereign God still ruled the nations of the world and will never let his eternal plan be overthrown. So, and he'll use evil, good and evil, to do that, and God will prevail. In this next section is actually verses 9. Hope you heard that. Verses 9 through 20, you have the witnessing of the lament of kings, merchants, and seamen. You have three different groups here who are quite upset. And it's not really, they aren't upset because Rome has fallen. They're upset, it seems, mainly because they're losing all the money that they had made, or the opportunity to make all the money they had been making. And so it's, you know, anyways. So you have three dirges in this next section regarding the fallen city of Babylon or Rome. This is modeled after Ezekiel's lamentation on Tyre, or over Tyre, T-Y-R-E, not T-I-R-E, in Ezekiel 27. Most of the same commodities are listed, and the Ezekiel version also contains mariners, merchants, and kings, so those three folks. So verses 9 through 10 are the kings of the earth who have shared the luxuries of Rome. Verses 11 through 17 are the merchants of the earth who have grown very rich by supplying Rome and providing all the luxuries for Rome. And verses 17 through 19 are the mariners, or the maritime trade that has prospered delivering to Rome over the last several years. So let's go through this. And you wonder why we don't do verse 20 as part of that, because, well, it's a little bit different, even though it's in this section. So let's read verse 9 through 20 of chapter 18. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city Babylon, the strong city, for 1 hour your judgment has come." 1 hour is not a literal hour. Please keep that in mind as we go through this. Just want to check something, a point of reference here. Yeah, okay. Verse 11, and the merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls and fine linen. Keep an eye out with what's being read here, what is being listed. Purple and silk and scarlet and every kind of citron wood and every article of ivory and every article made from very costly wood and bronze and iron and marble and cinnamon and spice and incense and perfume and frankincense and wine and olive oil and fine flour, wheat and cattle, sheep and cargoes of horses and chariots and slaves and human lives. Look how both are listed here. Let's see what this one says here. Slaves and human lives in verse 13. There's more to that. I'm sorry for the delay there, but I was just looking at, just trying to recall the slaves and human lives, the differences between the two, and we'll get there and we get to it. The fruit you long for has gone from you, and all things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you, and the men will no longer find them. The merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city, she who is clothed in the fine linen, purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in 1 hour such great wealth has been laid waste, and every shipmaster and every passenger and sailor, and as many as make their living by the sea, stood at a distance and were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What city is like the great city?' And they threw dust on their heads and were crying, weeping, and mourning, saying, 'Woe, woe, the great city in which all who has ships at sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she has been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her. We'll read the last ones here in a bit. So we see how verse 20 was a little bit different. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints. A little bit different from the dirge, the three dirges of the kings, merchants, and sailors. But going back to verse 9, let's look at the kings of the earth. These are the same kings from chapter 17, verse 16, the ones who turned against Rome to bring her down to destruction. But here at this point, they're allies of Rome who have grown wealthy off of the Roman exploits and oppression. As you can see, they don't care about Rome. They care about their wealth. And they'll take out Rome if they find that it'll be to their benefit. So this isn't like some sort of good allied relationship. It is allies in air quotes because they're pretty much just using each other to get what they want. They're the ones who leached off of Rome in a perverted political order that would keep them safe. They know if they signed on with Rome, that Rome would provide them some sort of level of protection as long as they paid whatever taxes they needed to. And for lack of a better word, they have whored themselves as prostitutes to Rome to gain their fortunes. Their fortunes have now changed, so they weep and wail. The beating of one's breast as the city goes down in fire smoke. Again, not for the people of Rome, but for their financial loss. The world leaders who have fallen into the adulterous trap of Rome lament at her disaster. Notice the kings do not go in to help, but instead stand at a distance, amazed at how quickly the powerful nation has gone down. There is amazement at how the once most powerful city in the existence of the world is now a smoldering heap. Oh, how the mighty fall. We do not need to look at, just to be sure here, we say this again, at the hour in which it went down as a literal hour, but more that John is telling us, where am I from? I'm just using my panhandle voice, is telling us that it happened very quickly, quite fast. To continue on here, we now enter the second dirge through verse 17, this time with a lament of the merchants. They do not lament because of their sympathy for Rome, but instead because they have lost a source of income. Nobody is left to buy their merchandise. That is why they are upset. From Pliny and Aristides, we know that the luxury of Rome was excessive. There are so many examples. I'm going to give very few. But one example could be one of Nero's banquets. The Egyptian roses alone would cost $100,000 in today's dollars. Vitellius, another Roman emperor, spent nearly $20 million on food in 1 year. In his 1 year reign, he had a penchant for eating peacocks and brains and many other exotic type things. The Talmud, which is the law of the written down law of the Jews, is written in that 10 measures of wealth. So what it would write is that 10 measures of wealth came down into the world. Rome received 9 and all the world 1. So that just kind of gives you a very, very brief idea. But I think a relatively good example about how wealthy Rome was compared to the rest of the world. Moving onward and forward, we look at verses 12 and 13. We are now given a list of imports that would have been brought from all over the world to the port of Ostia, which was the large port there in Rome. And it is a similar inventory to what we see in Ezekiel 27, where Tyre is the maritime capital at that time. We have 29 items broken down into 6 groups. You have your precious metals and gems group. You have your fabrics for expensive clothing. You have your ornamental pieces. You have your aromatic substances. You have your foodstuffs. You have your animal and people. What he provides here in this list helps those following along to understand the amount of wealth that was going into Rome. I mean, it was just probably inconceivable, I would assume. Just a few examples or explanations of what they saw there. The silver most likely is based on the idea that Roman women would only take baths in silver tubs, or tubs made out of silver. That's quite fancy. Generals in battle would require that they be served off of silver dishes. So would you like that on a silver platter? Maybe that's where that came from. Silk, which we know came from China, was very expensive. It was so abundant in Rome that the soldiers in the army were actually, many of them were arrayed in silken garments. Cinnamon was also imported from South China. So as you can imagine, that became very expensive. Wealthy Romans would eat off of plates made out of ivory. They would take baths in silver and eat off of ivory. Citron was a dark wood out of North Africa that was used for furniture. Seneca had 300 tables of this type of wood with ivory feet. It was a very expensive and hard to work with, but very beautiful type furniture. The dye purple was from Phoenicia and was extracted one drop at a time from a shellfish called a murex. So as you can imagine, that probably took a little bit of time. So of course, was very expensive. The word spice would be representing an Eastern perfume used to scent the hair. There's much more, but I think we get the point. But just to give you an idea from the perspective of symbolism, we end up with 28 items because four was the number of the world, which is typically symbolic of the number of the world, and seven is the number of completeness, which is 4 times 7 equals 28. So we have 28 items here, which then of course would tell us what was there represents all of the products of the world had made their way to Rome. The word translated for slaves literally means bodies. It is believed that the list is in order of value. So this list of 28 things is listed in order of value, with the least valuable listed last. So that kind of tells you how they felt about humans during this time period, showing us a significant amount of contempt for human life in which the wealth of Rome was built upon. It is believed that during this time period, there were 60 million slaves in the Roman Empire, listed here as human livestock. This is more than those who served in the households of the Romans, but also those who would die as entertainment as they fought there in the Colosseums of Rome. So as you can see, there's zero respect. The idea of slaves and human lives, I believe human lives could also be translated as souls, as in the amount of people who are just defeated, their souls taken from them, who are just, I guess, or souls as in their lives were destroyed. It was like a soulless existence. Their lives were destroyed by the oppression of Rome. Flying along here, verse 14, John now continues the narrative after the listing of merchandise. The merchants lament the fact that all the rich luxuries that Rome longed for has vanished forever, never to be recovered. Were also said to be, no one buys their cargoes anymore. So that's a pretty bad deal there in verse 14. Verses 15 through the first part of 17, they had profited greatly from the lively trade with the great capital of the world's empire. They also, as you'll notice, also as the kings did, they take their stand at a long distance and weep and mourn from afar. Again, we get another triplet. From John, the merchants describe the city as dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, glitters with gold, precious stones, and pearls. So it kind of provides that literary function to help us identify what is going on there. Notice that each group sees the fall of Rome in terms of their own interests. We'll see that with the sailors or mariners here in a second. They mourn because how quickly the great riches of Rome have been laid desolate. So thus they weep, thus they mourn because of what has happened. It's amazing how quickly we're going through this. And the reason that is because, well, we could hit a lot of details, like what all those little pieces of things were. But, you know, we're at a point where we're trying to tell a larger story, a bigger picture of what's going on and the desolation of Rome at this point. So as we continue on, the dirge continues, but now with the mariners, those who are involved, of course, with the shipping industry. The sea captain was the one who piloted and is not the owner. Sometimes those terms are confused in translation, which is why I bring that up. I believe in Acts there's some confusion about the time that Paul has a second shipwreck. I think there's confusion on that one. We're looking not only at the captain, but also the sailors, the rank and file, as well as all the passengers on the ship is what he's referring to. Those who work the sea could be anything from merchants to pearl divers to fishermen. They lament as they sit again at a distance, like those who looked on at Tyre in Ezekiel 27. They cry out in amazement that their wealth and fortunes are now gone at the demise of the city of Rome. In verse 19, they continue on here. These seafaring folks are shown in a picture of despair and lament, similar again to what we see in Tyre, where they throw dust on their heads and raise a mournful lament. They are so upset because of the wealth they will lose, and not so much about, again, like I said, the fate of the city. So it's a very, they don't really care. They don't care about Rome. If another city pops up and the Parthians show up and they have a big, powerful city, the merchants and the sailors and the kings will then go and try to do their best to become wealthy off the Parthians. So it's like there was any sort of real desire to be part of Rome beyond just the amount of wealth that Rome could provide. Verse 20 is a quick transition from a lament to a time of rejoicing, which keeps things consistent with the apocalypse. You see that on and on. It is debated what this call of rejoicing is to or from. Some say it is the call of the church to rejoice after her suffering. However, it seems that the call is addressed to heaven. Based on this being consistent with chapter 12, verse 12, this is the glorified church, not the believers on earth, who are to rejoice. We see here that the church is victorious to rejoice that God is the righteous judge and has turned evil away and turned away the oppressor and has brought judgment upon the one who has been accusing the church. As we end this section, we see that all sectors of the earth are mourning the wealth they will lose as Rome falls. Again, note that is not them mourning the lost lives or even the loss of a great city and everything that's tied to a great city, but the loss of their own wealth. We can again see how humans are so self-centered and opportunistic, as it typically is in human nature. And nay, that you say, I am not self-centered or opportunistic. Well, then again, reflect on your week. I needed to, and I did, and yes, we all are at some level in some capacity. So repent, my friends, repent and move forward and be faithful to God. Last section, verses 21 through 24. Then a strong angel, a strong one, I wonder about those from the other ones, took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, so will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer. I thought this already happened. Why is he saying this will happen? What? And the sound of harpists and musicians and flute players and trumpeters will not be heard in you any longer, and no craftsman of any craft will be found in you any longer, and the sound of a mill will not be heard in you any longer. You like how he does that? Any longer, in you any longer, in you any longer. And it continues, and the light of a lamp will not shine in you any longer, and the voice of the bridegroom and bride will not be heard in you any longer, for your merchants were the great men of the earth, because all the nations were deceived by your sorcery. In her was found the blood of prophets and saints and all who have fallen slain on the earth.
Wow. Wow.
Crazy town. That's all I got to say. All right. Verses 21 through 24. Babylon is destroyed. In the previous section of verses 9 through 19, we see what happens to the commercial allies of Rome. In this next and final section of chapter 18, we'll see Rome collapse from within. So we have the exact same thing going on, but from an internal perspective from previously, the three judges being from an external perspective of what is happening to Rome. And so all the arts, crafts, commerce, and customs of the great city will implode and will never recover is what he's saying. You'll note that six times in verses 20 through 23, we see never again, or you'll also see found in you any longer, hurting you in any longer. So it's just we see that, and he's providing that to give us a bit really good perspective. From a historical prophetic perspective, we are looking at an event in the times of Jeremiah when I think it's the quartermaster is sent to Babylon and reads a prophetic oracle against Babylon, which is in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 59. The seer sees a vision of a large angel with a large boulder thrown into the sea, symbolizing that Babylon and Rome will never be seen again. This is the third time we encounter a large angel. We saw one as the guardian of the great scroll in chapter 5, verse 2, and we saw another strong angel in chapter 10, verse 1, coming from heaven with a small scroll. So this is the first time we have a strong angel without a scroll. The type of violence in which it is being described here is similar to when we see the herd of swine run down the hill and into the lake in Mark 5 through 13, or when Acts 19, 29, the great crowd rushed upon the theater in Ephesus to go after Paul. So quite a hectic situation. Hectic is probably not the right word. Dire? I don't know. Anyways, The mill boulder, the millstone slash boulder, is thrown and just it not just falls into the sea, helps emphasize the violence and speed in which the destruction of Rome will happen. So it's not like it rolls off a cliff, or it breaks off the side of a mountain and rolls down. It is thrown in. It is intentional. It happens quickly. But not only Rome. So we have to take this as more than just Rome. The entire anti-Christian world and its opposition to God is being destroyed as well. That destruction will come to those things as well. Verses 22 through 23, in the form of a poem, John writes his part of a poem, describes how life and lives of Rome will disappear, never to be there again. All the musicians will disappear, there will no longer be music in the streets of Rome, and an eerie silence will come over the great city. The listing of the instruments will make more sense if we look back at Isaiah 5:12, where harp and flute are associated with carousing. Not only music will go away, but so will the sounds of the craftspeople doing their work. The productivity of the economy has now stopped. This is followed by the cessation of food, which is basically the idea that the millstone will no longer be heard, so no more grain to be processed, because they made a lot of stuff out of grain, and so we know that there will be hunger at that point. Israel does get a similar warning back in chapter 25, verse 10, the sounds of joy and gladness, the voices of bride and bridegroom, the sound of millstones and the lights of the lamp will no longer exist. It is not by accident that John spends so much time in the prophets, as he was very familiar with the work of the prophets and what they wrote. We also see that the lights went out as well. Not sure if he's referring to streetlights or the torches that slaves would carry as they escorted the wealthy from one place to another at night. Also could be a reference to how the craftspeople's shops would be lit up all the time, all hours of the night to fulfill orders. Either way, they would all go out, so those craftsmen would no longer be working because they would have nothing left to do. So alas, in this dark and desolate place, that once thrived, we see that the closest of all relationships will cease to exist, that of matrimony. The sounds of weddings will no longer exist in the city. So John is just hitting every part and piece of this. I must go on. 23, second part of 23. Some would say there is a disconnect between the first part and the second part of this verse. Both seem to provide reasons for the judgment that has come upon Rome, and each is a repetition of what we have seen earlier. So that's good to know. The merchants of Rome have become very powerful people, magnates even, so also a bit arrogant. I think a bit arrogant is a little understated. Their wealth that they gained through the growth of Rome has made them very powerful. They have been known as the great ones based on how they've deceived and hurt everyone else. Rome has deceived many of the nations with its magic or sorcery. We do not have to think of this as actual magic or sorcery. However, the black arts were very well known and used in Rome during this time, so maybe it was. I doubt it is, but maybe it was. I think we should take it more as that Rome had become very good at the art of deception, and Rome had bewitched the nations into a false sense of security, leading them to believe that Rome was a city that would be eternal, as in a divine city. So they had quite bewitched, much like the show, I think it was the 50s and 60s, where the witch lady and her mother lived together, and the nose thing would then make something happen. Similar sort of thing here. Verse 24, we are not provided the last and ultimate reason that Rome was judged because of the blood of the Christian martyrs that was spread throughout Rome. Notice that the guilt of Rome is to be spread throughout all of the earth, as it was Rome who is the reigning sovereign power of all the world. All loss of life was at the door of Rome, for she was guilty. We know from Cain and in Genesis 4 that the blood of innocent victims cries out for vengeance. Abel's blood cries out to God from the ground. Recall the martyrs from chapter 6 demanding to know how long it would take until their blood was avenged. We don't need to take the prophets and saints as two separate groups here whenever you see that being listed, where it says the blood of the prophets and saints. It's the same. It's not like you have a set apart class like we talked about earlier. with that. You could look at it, though, however, is that they're all saints, but the prophets could be a special group within the saints. So, because all believers are saints. The people of the time would still have seared in their minds the massacre under Nero in AD 64, as well as the current issues they were dealing with Domitian, who was about as unpleasant as Nero was. We can take from this that the judgment of Rome and John's view is the eschatological perspective or judgment that would come upon the entire world at the consummation of human history. We know that John thought these things would soon take place, going back to 1:1, but we are 2,000 years in at this point. So what this could tell us is that the forces that exemplified Rome will be the same forces which will play the major role at the end of human history. So we can do that. We don't want to do too much of that, because then we start trying to make dates and claiming things and acting like we know things that we don't know. But I think that's what John is pointing to, this is how the world will be working, possibly, at that time period. We have to remember that prophecy in its nature has a hard time being forced into a specific sequence. So just because John is writing it out this way doesn't mean it's going to happen in this way or in this sequence. We know that many things that he teaches and talks about is not in a chronological order, but more in a symbolic order. However, what we can get out of all this is the guarantee, the ultimate issues of God's redemptive program, which God's redemptive program will be completely fulfilled at the consummation of human history. So that's what we can get out of that. And I think with joy, we can walk forward and see how that all plays out. Look at that. Chapter 18, 1 through 24 is all done. Next time is chapter 19. What we're going to do is spend the next 4 weeks. We'll do a chapter a week the next 4 weeks. Chapter 19 next week. And then chapter 22, 4 weeks from now. So anyways, have a good day. Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.